In the wake of the September 11 attacks, the United States captured hundreds of suspected al-Qaeda terrorists in Afghanistan and around the world. The following January, the first of these prisoners arrived at the U.S. military's prison camp at Guantanamo Bay, where they were subject to President Bush's executive order authorizing trial by military commissions. Jess Braven is the Wall Street Journal Supreme Court correspondent. He was there within days of the prison's opening and has continued to cover the U.S.'s controversial effort to create a parallel justice system for enemy aliens. His new book is The Terror Courts, Rough Justice at Guantanamo Bay, and it's a great pleasure to have Jess Braven join us on the program. Thank you very much.
Hey, my pleasure.
What brought you initially to write about this in book form of sort of take a macro lens look at what was going on and what continues to go on?
Well, you know, when President Bush signed this military order in 2001 and authorizing military commissions to try enemy aliens, it struck me as an incredible legal story because it was a form of justice he was invoking that really had not been used since World War II. It was the sort of thing that I had maybe seen newsreels about or, you know, programs on the History Channel, but it was really a dormant area of law, not the kind of thing that anyone studies or had any kind of exposure to in our day. And so the sense of resurrecting this old form of justice on the battlefield struck me as a tremendously important development. And it was one of the, and as a legal reporter, it was the kind of thing that I would want to cover. So I really began digging into it then, and it's remained an incredible story since. It has not worked out over the past 12 years any way near what I expected would be happening back when the whole project was devised right after 9/11.
Talk about the devising of you at one point referred to it as a legal experiment. What exactly was the thought process behind it? Because you get the sense in the book that it wasn't really as thought out as you would think it would be.
Well, the question really is, you know, what is the purpose of setting up a parallel justice system? It was not, it turns out, because the Justice Department or the Defense Department or the CIA said, we're going to be capturing people. We have no confidence in our existing methods of dealing with criminals or terrorists or war criminals. We need to create something from scratch that can handle them. It didn't, you know, and what can we do? It didn't begin that way, and it did not begin from asking the question, what is the best way to handle enemy prisoners, and then going through various alternatives. Instead, it was really a top-down decision. There were people in the Bush administration who had been thinking about this concept for a very long time, for years, really since the Lockerbie bombing back in the 1980s when Pan Am 103 blew up. And 9/11 was an opportunity to put into action a lot of these ideas they had been nursing for a very long time. So it was a top-down solution, but it was not to the problem of what can we do about 9/11. Really, it was a much broader goal. It was to say, you know, 9/11 has made necessary a very, very expansive presidential power, and military commissions are a way to demonstrate that. They're a way to show really the outer limit of what a president can do invoking his war power. And because it was a top-down kind of decision, it really played out the way many of those have done throughout history. The political leadership comes up with an idea and delegates it to the career military to implement, and then moves on to other things. And what my story is really about is what those, you know, what happened, both the way that policy was devised and then when it fell into the hands of primarily military officers given the task of implementing it.
So the administrators who are implementing it are really guessing their way through this. The judges ultimately become underqualified because they have never done anything like this before.
Well, that's and that plays into sort of the bigger picture because, you know, when you think about dealing with terrorists, well, who would you rather deal with, these, you know, extraordinarily dangerous people who want to kill civilians? Well, the military is a pretty tough organization, and that comes to mind as perhaps the right institution to take them on. But when it comes to putting them on trial, the kinds of competence that the military has may not be as suited as people would expect, because the military justice system was not designed to deal with sophisticated national security threats, it was designed to deal with the kind of problems and crimes that arise on military bases around the world. Things, you know, domestic violence, larceny, drug crimes, things like that are the types of crimes that military judges and military lawyers have experience with, because that's what happens on military bases. Gigantic international conspiracies are not what happens, and they did not really have a lot of background going into it. At the same time, though, the administration, once it issued this order, it really moved on. They were moving on to plan the Iraq war and that kind of thing, and this project was sort of left adrift. And for years, there were great struggles between military prosecutors and military investigators with the CIA and other agencies over how suspects were to be treated and how trials were to be conducted and what kind of evidence would be made available. And it's really that story, once the White House has moved on to its other ambitions, that I think brings us to the point we are today, where this project is still underway in modified form.
You tell the story of Marine officer Lieutenant Colonel Stuart Couch. Talk a little bit about how this Lieutenant Colonel risked his career.
Well, he is, I think, a perfect example of the kind of values that that many in our military have, and the type of strain that they were placed under with the U.S. Response to 9/11, a quite extraordinary response, certainly in legal terms and in the way that Americans treated enemy prisoners. Colonel Couch is a career Marine. He had been a pilot before he went to law school, and one of his flying buddies, in fact, was one of the victims on 9/11. A guy named Mike Horrocks had been in his Marine flying squadron, was behind the controls on United 175 when that plane was hijacked and later crashed into the South Tower of the World Trade Center. So Couch had both a personal and a patriotic reason to want to sign up for prosecution of terrorists, because, you know, let's face it, if you're a military lawyer, your chance of going to the front line is pretty low, but your chance of getting into the courtroom, obviously much higher. Once he, though, got involved in this system, he found himself embroiled in case after case that had been damaged by government misconduct, and perhaps that became most dramatic in the case of a detainee who is still at Guantanamo Bay named Mohamedou Ould Slahi. If you look at the 9/11 report, it's online, you can find Mr. Slahi in that report. He is accused of helping recruit the Hamburg cell, including Mohammed Atta, that joined the 9/11 plot and actually hijacked planes. And the Slahi case is fascinating because he was a very sophisticated operative who had resisted interrogation both before 9/11, when he had run into law enforcement, and after, when he ended up at Guantanamo Bay. But it was only after military intelligence began, in Couch's view, torturing him, that the guy cracked and began giving up verifiable information. The problem for Couch, as he began putting the case together, was that all the evidence against this guy came from torture, and it put him really in a moral and legal dilemma. A legal dilemma because American law and treaties that the United States has ratified prohibit using evidence taken from torture in proceedings. That's just a flat-out exclusionary rule. Morally, because he felt it was wrong to do the kinds of things that were done to break this prisoner, he said it was, in his view, un-American, and he could not really stand up in court and represent the United States under those kind of circumstances. So he refused to make that case go forward, and to this day it remains in limbo. And that's not the kind of thing that anyone expected out of military officers. When the plan for military commissions was first announced, a lot of the critics said, oh, it's just going to be a kangaroo court. The participants are going to salute smart and railroad prisoners. That is really not what has happened, I think, to surprise both the backers and critics of that project.
When you talk about the political interference and how it got in the way with this legal and military tradition and the way things had been done in the past, what do you think was the political motivation?
It varied from case to case, but one thing was very clear, certainly in the earlier years of this project, which was that military commissions, or securing justice in the sense of putting people on trial for their crimes was not a high priority in the Bush administration. And that became clear in a number of cases. For instance, the first people that military prosecutors identified to put on trial among the detainee population at Guantanamo were a group of, or a number of British citizens who had been captured in Afghanistan or Pakistan. And the prosecutors felt there was strong evidence connecting them to al-Qaeda networks. However, the British government felt that this system of military trials was so unfair that they would not stand for putting British citizens on trial for it. And it became a political problem for Tony Blair, then the British Prime Minister, who was one of very few allies behind the United States in the Iraq War. And so President Bush, to accommodate Tony Blair, simply canceled the trials of these people, and eventually they were released and sent back to Britain, where they are free. Now, of course, they were not convicted of anything. We can't say they're guilty. People are presumed innocent. But it was a tremendously demoralizing start for military commissions, because the officers there were placed in this position of really two untenable explanations. Either those people who were released and sent back to Britain were really not that dangerous, and therefore the implication being that they were being railroaded, or they really were dangerous, and they were being released for political reasons as a political favor, which undermines the whole concept of equal justice without fear or favor. So that was one example. Another example involving, as well, another ally in the Iraq War was Australia. And there were two Australian detainees held at Guantanamo Bay. There was a lot of pressure coming from the Australian government to put these people on trial or release them. In Australia, public opinion did not favor the idea of Australian citizens being held indefinitely without charge. The sense from the Australian government of Prime Minister John Howard was, try them or release them, but don't just leave them sitting there. So there was a tremendous amount of pressure to put those two Australians on trial in one case, and this is another case involving Colonel Couch, where he felt the evidence simply did not support the charge. And he had to go through a remarkable series of behind-the-scenes maneuvers to stop a case going forward against someone who he thought simply, reprehensible as the guy's views might be, he clearly was a sympathizer of some of al-Qaeda's aims. That's a different story from actually being involved in a terrorist plot. These kinds of things would really be totally beyond the pale in the conventional civilian or the conventional justice system. We don't see the White House reaching into specific prosecutions to maneuver and manipulate the way they play out.
Jess Braven is the author of The Terror Court's Rough Justice at Guantanamo Bay. In looking at the charges of prisoner abuse at Guantanamo, you write about this, but what impact did it have on the government's cases against these terrorism suspects?
Well, remarkably, it continues to have an impact, because one can't undo the past, and these cases pretty much have all been affected by allegations of coercion, if not torture. And maybe the most dramatic example is going on right now. Pretrial proceedings are underway. They may be paused temporarily, but they are underway at Guantanamo Bay for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the self-confessed mastermind of 9/11, and four co-defendants, leading to what the government hopes will be a trial that begins in 2014. And the proceedings there are kind of amazing, because they're almost backwards. I mean, normally in trials we see the defendant, particularly a guilty defendant, trying to conceal everything he did and prevent the facts from coming out in court through all kinds of means, while the government tries to make it as visible as possible. Here it's the other way around. The defendants are fanatics who are quite proud of attacking the United States and have said in court that they are ready for martyrdom as they see it. But the government has been making motions and taking all kinds of steps to prevent what it already did to the defendants when they were in secret CIA prisons from being exposed to the public. And there could be serious consequences for the case itself, because pretty much this is not a case that anyone thinks is, mistaken identity or anything like that. I mean, this is a case where there is tremendous evidence that the defendants are guilty, since they've already tried to plead guilty. The question is, when we get, the defense has said this, once they're convicted, what is the punishment going to be? And the defense, I think, is likely to say that the severe treatment, the abusive treatment, the torture that they allege these defendants underwent should deprive the government of the death penalty. And that actually is not an unusual argument. When there is government misconduct or government abuse of a defendant, a typical remedy is to lessen the punishment that that defendant gets, even when they're convicted, to sort of punish the government for its misconduct. So I think that if there is a conviction, there will be a very strong push to limit the punishment for some or all of those defendants because of the severe treatment that even the president today admits was wrong.
And on that very point, as you bring forth in the book, that the reforms that have been adopted by the Obama administration, it's questionable how effective they can be because of these past abuses.
Well, there is a sort of irony in that the first version of military commissions that President Bush imagined was thrown out by the Supreme Court in 2006. A modified version was adopted by Congress that year, and then it was revised again in 2009 at President Obama's instigation. And each of those iterations has given defendants greater rights and made the trials more closely resemble what goes on in a court-martial or a U.S. federal court. And if they had started out with a current system instead of getting to it, after years and years of internal fighting, maybe things would look different. But there's no question that what's going on now is considerably more fair by any standard than what was originally imagined. The problem is that sort of undermines the premise or the whole purpose of a military commission in the first place, because since they were designed to be expedient, rapid, efficient ways to quickly get to resolution and move on, anything you do that gives defendants more rights undermines that goal. Furthermore, the exclusionary rules already limit evidence taken from torture, evidence taken through coercion and other unlawful means. So the idea that military courts would be more amenable to questionable evidence may not be true, if not at trial, perhaps on appeal. And so everything that's done to make these things more fair almost begins to beg the question of, well, then why not just use the existing court system? Because these trials are subject to a lot of legal uncertainty and a lot of appeals because they have very untested mechanisms and a statute that has never really been examined by the Supreme Court. So there is an uncertainty that clouds them that you wouldn't have in a court martial or a federal court. And the question that I think Americans should consider is what you're getting out of this new system worth the huge expense and the tremendous uncertainty that goes with it? And the answer may be yes. I mean, and a lot of obviously the Congress and the President think the answer is yes. So this is not necessarily an easy question to answer. But it's important to see what it is that's really going on with this system and making that judgment yourself.
You used the word irony a moment ago, and I guess that is apt also when, as you point out, that ultimately the military commissions have, when you look at it as a whole, have imposed lighter sentences than federal courts have in the past for very comparable offenses.
Yeah, and that's something I think surprised both the advocates and critics of this project, who both imagined that you would have military officers who'd understand that their job was to convict and punish harshly anyone who was marched in front of them. And that is not how our military officers, by and large, reacted when given this assignment. And as we talked about one of the prosecutors earlier, Colonel Couch, this played out in the one contested trial that they have had, and which I covered from start to finish, which was that of Osama bin Laden's former driver, a guy named Salem Hamdan. This was a situation where the military commission, six officers that heard the evidence and listened to the arguments and so forth, when they acquitted him of one count, they convicted him of another count called material support for terrorism. The government asked for 30 years to life, and the military jury came back within a couple hours with a sentence of 5.5 months plus time served. And Mr. Hamdan was, in fact, released in early 2009 after finishing that 5.5 month sentence. And that really shocked everyone. I interviewed the foreman of the jury who said, well, you know, their job was to look at the evidence and make their own judgments, and that's what they did. By comparison, a guy named John Walker Lind, who some people might remember was the so-called American Taliban,
right,
captured Afghanistan in late 2001, he pleaded guilty in a plea bargain to the same offense, the civilian version of that offense, material support for terrorism, and got 20 years, and he's still in federal prison today. And that was not atypical. Now, there have not been a lot of trials because there have been a lot of problems in getting them off the ground. There have only been about a half dozen cases that went all the way through, and most of those were plea bargains. So there are not a lot of examples. But from regardless of the actual rules on paper that are supposed to govern these proceedings, the way that the military judges and jurors have actually carried out their duties has been, I think, a surprise to a lot of people who expected something to be far less careful and far less concerned about being fair.
Well, this is a very readable and important account. The Terror Court's Rough Justice at Guantanamo Bay. It is published by Yale. Jess Braven, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for your work and for sharing it with us.
My pleasure, Joe.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, The Terror Courts. It's published by Yale. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.